Good evening, friends. Welcome to another edition of Valley Writers Read, a show where Central California authors are able to read their stories. Tonight, a biography of a famous athlete from Bakersfield by the name of Claude Varner. He turned out to be the featherweight boxing champion of the world. His story is written up by his nephew, James Varner, who entitles it Uncle Dudley. And here is Pat Smith to read Uncle Dudley by James Varner.
Uncle Dudley. Uncle Dudley was the third eldest brother in my dad's family. Dad had seven brothers. Dad was one of eight boys. Otis, Chet, Claude, who was Uncle Dudley, Pat, Bob, who was my dad, John, Bill, and Skeet. There was a sister Margaret between Chet and Claude. She died when she was in her early 20s. The family's not forthcoming about what happened to her. I believe it had something to do with a pregnancy complication. Whatever it was, the Varner boys ran her husband out of town. The Varner boys were all characters. Each has his own unique story. They were tough as nails, like all true Texans. I do not know how Uncle Claude got the nickname Uncle Dudley. It could have been the way he dressed up in his best Sunday duds to go out on the town. Floor-shine shoes, neatly pressed slacks, bright-colored shirt, velvet vest, tweed sports coat, sporty hat, and a flower in his lapel. He also had a gold watch with a plumb bob in the vest pocket. He was a snappy dresser. He may have coined this name for himself. He had nicknames for everybody. Often he used the same nickname for several people, particularly the kids. He referred to my sister and me as pumpkin heads. Not that we had big orange heads. It was just his endearing and joyful way of a greeting. Uncle Dudley was full of energy when he came to visit. He would bounce me on his knee and say, "How's my pumpkin head?" Then he would give me something, a shiny silver dime or a stuffed toy. Once he gave me a real stuffed koala bear that he brought back from Australia. The neatest gift he ever gave me was a walnut shell he had hollowed out and inserted four little wooden pegs to resemble legs into, a peg for a tail, and two small pegs for ears. It had a small nodule for a head. It looked like a tiny pig. The pegs were loose and could move. He would nab a fly out of the air with his bare hands, put the fly in the nut, and it would walk around the table. Uncle Dudley had fast hands. When he returned from his last trip to Australia, he brought back a wife. He kept the wife for himself, however. Aunt Marge was a novelty, a petite redhead with a thick Aussie accent. Uncle Dudley met Marge at the horse races. Her brother was the jockey who rode a horse named Varner that Uncle Dudley owned. Uncle Dudley was quite popular in Australia, particularly after he won the World Championship featherweight boxing title under the Australian flag. This feisty little American guy came to Australia and won a world championship boxing title for them. Well, I guess that would make one rather popular. The championship fight was held at the Fitzroy Stadium in Melbourne, Australia in 1938. Uncle Dudley fought and defeated Mickey Miller, Australia's golden boy and then featherweight champion. This fight so upset the backers of Miller that it started a riot. Mervyn Lewis Williams, the referee of the match, was fired by the Fitzroy Boxing Stadium, and shortly thereafter, Miller hung up his gloves, never to fight again. Claude not only defeated Mickey Miller, but challenged and knocked out Australia's top middleweight, lightweight, and bantamweight fighters. You might be wondering why a patriotic American boy would go to another country and win a world title for them rather than his own country. Well, there was a good life-or-death reason. Uncle Dudley was born James Claude Varner in Fort Worth, Texas, July 17, 1908. The Varners moved around a lot in the Fort Worth and Dallas area. Pop Varner moved from job to job as a farm laborer or dairyman. The Varner boys moved from school to school, always making new starts and meeting new challenges. By 1925 and the birth of the youngest Varner, Skeet, Claude was 17 years old. There were five more boys in the family to share life, clothes, food, and sleeping space. In a 600-square-foot house with one bed, two adults, seven boys, a girl, and a baby, sleeping space was hard to come by. My dad told me the way they handled this sleeping space problem was that they put the youngest to bed first. When he fell asleep, they would lay him in the corner, then put the next youngest to bed. When he fell asleep, they would stand him in the corner. So it would go until only Mom and Pop were left, and they got to bed for the rest of the night. There's always a way to solve a problem. Claude ran around with a bunch of tough kids that played football and baseball. One of the boys was doing some boxing at Burke Burnett Park in Fort Worth. The prize for the winner was a watermelon. Claude thought, that looks like fun. He took home many a watermelon to the family dinner table. Claude's brother Chet left home at about age of 14 to seek his fortune in the world. His wanderings eventually led him to Westwood, California, somewhere between Sacramento and Mount Shasta. He found work in the lumber mills. By age 22, Chet has worked his way up to a millwright position at the Red River Lumber Company. He developed tools to cut moldings and was making good money for the time. He sent money home to help the family out. In 1925, work was slow in the Fort Worth, Dallas area, so Claude and his brother Pat took off to join Chet in Westwood to try their luck at the lumber mill. After a rigorous journey of hitchhiking, hopping trains, and walking, they made it to Westwood and got jobs at the same mill where Chet worked. Work was good, so word and money were sent home to tell of their good fortune. In 1926, Pop Varner and Otis followed their footsteps and headed for Westwood, too. They also got work, and all was going well until Claude had a run-in with one of the tough guy lumberjacks. Claude, who was by now 18 years old, had gotten a job in the business office doing clerical work. One payday, when the whistle blew to call an end to the workday, the workers started filing in to line up to get paid. Claude, being in the office, just walked out of the room he was working in and was first in line. Claude was talking to one of the other workers when in came a burly lumberjack and crowded to the front of the line. Claude said, "Hey, Buster, wait your turn." "Yeah? And who's going to make me?" was the reply. Well, the lumberjack didn't know it at the time, but that wasn't something to say to a Varner. Words exchanged and things got heated up, but one of the bosses came in and calmed it down. The jacks got their money and left. Claude started to leave, too. The path home went by a small railroad station. When he got to the train tracks, the lumberjack and a few of his buddies were waiting. More words flew as a small crowd gathered to see what was going to happen. The lumberjack launched an attack toward Claude. Claude sidestepped him and then let the lumberjack have it with a solid 1-2, and the lumberjack fell like a sack of potatoes. When he fell, he hit his head on a track. The lumberjack never got up. He died instantly. In the crowd watching, there happened to be a deputy sheriff who told Claude he saw the whole thing, and it was definitely a matter of self-defense, but he better get out of town right away. He also told Claude, "You're pretty good with your hands," and he gave Claude the name of a fight promoter in the Fresno and Bakersfield area. That night, Claude, no jacket and 10 cents in his pocket, hopped the next train out of town and headed south down the valley to face the unknown. The train made a stop in Sacramento. Claude, feeling hungry, jumped off the train, found a store, and bought a box of saltine crackers with his dime. When he arrived in Fresno, he was tired, hungry, and broke. He looked for the promoter the sheriff told him about and found the gym where the boxers worked out. There was a fight coming up the next day. Claude looked around and told himself, "These guys don't look so tough. I'm going to challenge a fight. It will be like winning a watermelon at the park." He got a good night's sleep standing in a corner. Did a challenge fight and won a few dollars, got something to eat, then hopped a train and continued south to the end of the line in Bakersfield. In the 20s, the main Bakersfield train station was on Sumner Street, just east of Baker in East Bakersfield. It was the end of the line for trains coming down the valley. The train pulled in late at night, and things were pretty quiet. Claude, having no idea where he was, asked around to find out where there might be some activity. Someone told him about Milo O'Dell's pool hall in downtown Bakersfield on 18th Street. Claude started walking till he found the pool hall. He went in and asked around if anyone knew where he could get a job. A fellow there playing cards by the name of Tuck Threewit told Claude he could use a hand at his farm. Threewit had a section of land where he grew cotton just outside of Bakersfield and south of a farm community called Weed Patch. The farmland was at a place called the Lake Bottom, somewhere between Lamont and the Grapevine. Claude went home with Threewit and to the Lake Bottom. Claude got a job at the Threewit farm, and things were going pretty well. Claude sent news to Westwood that there was plenty of work at the Threewit farm. Pat Varner came down and got a job with Threewit. Claude gave his brother Pat direction to O'Dell's pool hall and told to ask there how to get to Threewit Farm. When Pat arrived at O'Dell's and asked the direction of the Threewit Farm, he was told to head south on Highway 99 to a weed patch road, turn east, and continue on to Weed Patch. Pat got mad and thought the guy was pulling his leg and making fun of him, telling him to go to a weed patch. It almost led to a fight. He finally convinced Pat that that was the real name to the town where Threewit could be found. Still not trusting what he was told, Pat set out, and to his surprise did find the town Weed Patch and the Threewit farm. Pop Varner came down shortly thereafter, and he too was hired on by Threewit. Due to his farming experience, Pop soon became the foreman overseeing cotton planting. Claude, along with Chuck's sons Paul and Buck, did the plowing to prepare the ground. Claude and Pop got room and board, plus a little money for expenses. Not long after Pat, Otis came down from Westwood. Otis got a job in a local dairy. Chet stayed in Westwood, remaining in the lumber business. In 1927, after the cotton harvest, Pop bought a Packard touring car, went to Texas, and brought the rest of the family to Bakersfield. With the exception of Chet, the family was together again. On weekends, Paul Threewit went into Bakersfield to box at the Tin Barn. The Tin Barn was an old barn turned into a fighting arena. The barn was located on 22nd and V Street, just west of what was Highway 99, now Union Avenue. Paul got paid $2 a round, plus extra if he won. Claude went into town with Paul one night to watch. When he saw how much money Paul made in one night, win, lose, or draw, which amounted to about $20, Claude wanted in on it. Paul set up a meeting with the promoter, a Mr. Kelly. Claude convinced Kelly he knew what he was doing, and Claude was promised a fight the next weekend. Claude showed up the next weekend, no gear, no proper boxing shoes, no trunks or gloves. Kelly didn't actually assign Claude a fight, as he had not cleared it with the owner, Milo O'Dell. Learning that he was not on the ticket, Claude became uncorked. He put up such a fuss that Kelly said, "Okay, if you're that eager to get your teeth knocked out, be my guest." So Claude got his fight. Paul commandeered Claude some gloves and shorts, but he had to wear his work boots. Claude was paired against an experienced fighter. As the story goes, Claude did very well the first round and knocked his opponent down. The opponent got up. The fight continued. Second round went the same, with a knockdown and the opponent getting back up. Claude had been in a few fights and won them all, but they were over very quick. After two rounds, Claude was pooped. His legs were giving out, his arms were tired, while the experienced fighter was just warming up. Claude was not in shape. Claude got worked over pretty good for the next two rounds. Due to sheer willpower, Claude was able to stay on his feet, and the match ended in a draw. Kelly was impressed. "Claude, my boy," he said, "you have some talent for this sport, but you need to get some training and get in shape." That night was the beginning of Claude's conditioning program and a 17-year boxing career that took him across the United States and all around the world, Canada, Mexico, England, Germany, New Zealand, and Australia. Claude has dined with royalty and conversed with rulers of nations. In 1935, Claude went on a boxing tour to Europe with the heavyweight boxer Steve Hamus. In England, after a victorious fight, Claude was visited in his dressing room by the Duke of Windsor to be congratulated for his performance. The Duke was particularly fond of Americans. That Duke was Edward VIII, who in 1936 became King of England. Edward abdicated his title that same year to marry his American love, Wallace Warfield Simpson. The House of Windsor and the Church of England would not tolerate the thought of the king marrying an American woman, particularly one who was a divorcee. Edward had to choose between his love for a woman and the power and status of a king. He made his decision and made a public radio broadcast on the evening of December 11, 1936, addressing the people of England, stating, "You must believe me when I tell you I have found it impossible to carry the heavy burden of responsibility and to discharge my duties as king as I would wish to do without the help and support of the woman I love." England missed out that day. He would have been a caring, benevolent king. In Germany, on the same boxing tour, Claude had a fight in Berlin. His fight there, too, was victorious. After the fight, none other than Adolf Hitler came to his dressing room to congratulate him. Too bad Claude wasn't clairvoyant. If he knew what this man was going to do to the world, he could have ended World War II before it started with a quick 1-2. By 1927, at age 19, Claude had trained at Milo O'Dell's gym and was in top physical condition. He had several boxing matches up and down the Central Valley. Claude was making a name for himself. He set up his own gym in a barn where the Varner family set up residence in Pumpkin Center. Not only Claude, but several of his brothers, Pat, Bob, John, and Bill, were working out at the makeshift Pumpkin Center gym as well. One of the local kids by the name of Jack LaLanne, who was at that time a scrawny kid with some health problems, came to work out. Jack LaLanne became the guru of fitness during the 40s, 50s, and 60s. He established gyms throughout California and set many fitness records. One of his latest feats was towing a boat while swimming the Straits of San Francisco between Alcatraz and the mainland, a very dangerous stretch of water. He was in his 60s at the time. One of his gyms was located on Nile Street in Bakersfield, just west of Mount Vernon. The gym is still there, but under a different name. In 1929, Claude, with several boxing victories to his name, the vast majority being knockouts, graduated from the Tin Barn and began training in Los Angeles at the Manhattan Gym owned and operated by Barney Dempsey, Jack Dempsey's brother. Claude's trainer was a George Moss. Claude did well, winning boxing match after boxing match. In 1931, after 12 straight KOs, Claude was ready for the big time. The New York Boxing Commission was developing a young boxer by the name of Fidel LaBarba. He, too, was winning all his matches. The New York Commission was looking for a West Coast boxer with accountability to match against LaBarba. They wanted to extend LaBarba's notoriety across the country. Moss was contacted, and a match was set up in Los Angeles. The main event at the Olympic Auditorium, Los Angeles, California, the evening of February 3, 1931, was Varner versus LaBarba. The Varner versus LaBarba match ended in a draw. New York was not happy. The match cost them a lot of money, and they were sure their prize boy, LaBarba, would be the victor. Who was this young upstart Varner? New York demanded a rematch. George Moss was intimidated by the New York Mafia that ran the Eastern boxing world. He was under their thumb now, and he felt the pressure. This pressure came down to Claude. New York told Moss LaBarba had to win the fight. Things got a little testy when Moss told Claude to take a dive. Claude said, "No way, I'm going to throw a match." The night of the rematch came along. This time, main event was on June 26, 1931 at Legion Stadium in Hollywood. Claude was in control of the match. In a clinch, LaBarba hit Claude with a low blow to the groin. This set Claude back a bit. The ref warned LaBarba, and the match continued. Soon they were in another clinch, and Claude returned the favor, and LaBarba felt the pain of a low punch. The ref told them to keep it clean or he would call the fight. As the match progressed, Claude hit LaBarba several times in the left eye, breaking a bone that protects the eye socket. LaBarba's eye injury eventually led to the end of his own boxing career. Claude won the match by a decision and was awarded the title of California's featherweight champion. The New York boys, expecting LaBarba to win, were furiously mad. They were out for blood. That's when it became necessary for Claude to get out of town. Claude joined up with a boxing friend, Todd Morgan, a junior lightweight world champion, and together they went to Australia to further their boxing careers. Claude created some waves with the Boxing Commission. Many of his matches were removed from or never recorded in the historical records. New York never recognized Claude's featherweight championship title, which he held for 4 years. That is, until another promising fighter came along by the name of Henry Armstrong. New York wanted a match between Armstrong and Varner. On his return to the U.S. from his 1935 trip in Europe, Claude landed in New York. There he hooked up with an experienced manager by the name of Charlie Harvey. Harvey set up fights for Claude in New York, Chicago, and Cincinnati, and negotiations started to arrange a match between Varner and Armstrong. During this time, Claude came back to California and was spending time on the family ranch that was by then in Shafter, California, northwest of Bakersfield. Pop had leased some land and was growing cotton. Claude was helping out with irrigating the crop. Irrigating the fields was a manual chore that required a shovel and a lot of digging to rotate water channels. It was customary to file a very sharp cutting edge on the end of the shovel head to easily cut through weeds and roots while digging channels for the water to flow. Claude had his sharp shovel draped over his shoulder when he jumped from one channel he had just dug to another. When he landed, he stumbled, and the shovel slipped out of his hand. The sharp head of the shovel came down just above the heel of his right foot. The blade of the shovel cut through and severed his Achilles tendon. Claude was rushed to a local Shafter doctor. The tendon had drawn up into Claude's calf. The doctor was able to reach up and pull the tendon down and sew the tendon back together. Claude was told he would probably have a club foot and have difficulty walking for the rest of his life. It looked like an end to his boxing days. The wound became infected, requiring several doctor visits to cut out rotten, infected flesh. Claude was on crutches for a year. Throughout this time, Claude never gave up his desire to re-enter the ring, and he never accepted the doctor's original prognosis. He massaged and exercised his foot daily. After a year, he said, "Enough of this," and threw away the crutches. He began to train again. His foot was never the same. He had to have specially made shoes for the ring and general wear. He could not move around in the ring like he did before the accident, but he was back in the ring and moving around pretty good. Good enough to win the title of featherweight champion of the world in 1938 when he defeated Mickey Miller in Australia. Negotiating for a match with Henry Armstrong had stopped. The match that was rumored to be the match of the century never took place. However, Claude and Armstrong did become friends. In the boxing world, there's a secret brotherhood and bond amongst the retired ex-prize fighters. Many of the fighters that did well in their youth and were on top with money in their pocket end up as has-beens on the street. Some of the old men selling programs in front of a stadium before a fight were themselves on the ticket in a former time. One day at the Varner Brothers sanitation office in Oildale, an old guy came in asking for Claude. Claude came out, and the two men hugged each other and faked a few punches. They talked for quite a while, and the man asked for a job. Claude told him this is not a good job for him and gave the man $200. And then the man left. "Who was that, Claude?" "That, boys, was Henry Armstrong, one hell of a good man and prize fighter." When Claude hung up his gloves in 1945 and returned to Bakersfield with his Australian wife, he joined his brothers, Bob, John, Bill, and Skeet, in the sanitation business and started to raise a family of his own. He continued to promote boxing and started youth boxing programs at gyms and a few high schools. As a young boy, I went to some of the programs he put on at Bakersfield's Strelick Stadium, the former Old Tin Barn. Claude brought boxing greats like Joe Louis to Bakersfield as a guest to some of these events. Claude wrote an article for the Oildale News titled Neutral Corner, where he wrote about the highlights of the sport and gave examples of life lessons learned. During the early 1960s, prior to Lady Bird Johnson's abolishment of pit and burn dumps, the Varner boys started a lucrative side business of salvaging metals from various dump sites up and down the Central Valley. After papers, cloth, and other perishable materials were burned off, all that was left were non-combustible metals. The metals were picked up by a large electromagnetic disc operated from a boom of a crane and loaded into trucks. The metals were taken to a shredder mill located on Round Mountain Road on the north side of the Kern River in Bakersfield. The trucks had a large metal box bed of about 8 feet wide, 20 feet long, and 12 feet high. As a young boy, I used to drive one of these trucks making hauls from dump sites to shredder. These trucks were loud and rattled. It was hard to hear yourself think driving one of these. On Friday, January 11, 1963, Uncle Dudley was driving one of these trucks, taking a load of metal to the shredder. At the crossroads of Highway 99 and Snow Road, The railroad tracks run parallel to 99. At that time, there was no stop bar or signal to warn a driver that a train is coming. Uncle Claude could not hear or see the train approaching the intersection. Claude turned across the tracks and was hit broadside at the cab of the truck. The train hit with such impact that it knocked the engine out of the truck and it landed several yards down the track. It is amazing that Claude was not killed instantly. His body was severely damaged. Claude survived a few days in and out of a coma, passing on January 14, 1963. The irony of this tragedy is that Claude's life career began with an incident at the railroad tracks, and his life experience came to a close at the railroad tracks. Claude left behind his lovely wife Marge, daughter Lois Marie, 14, son Roger, 13, and twin daughters Joan and Janet, 9, and 7 brothers. That was a mournful day for the Varner family. During World War II, Uncle Skeet, the youngest of the Varner boys, was serving in the Army. Skeet was stationed in the Philippines. His unit was assigned a duty attached to an Australian unit. During the course of the assignment, there was some male testosterone and tension building up between the Aussies and the Americans. One particular Aussie singled out Skeet and challenged a fight. One of the other Aussies noticed the name Varner on his uniform and asked if he knew a Claude Varner. "Yes, he's my brother," was the reply. Skeet was immediately accepted as one of the boys. The two units worked harmoniously for the rest of the assignment. To honor their brother, the Varner boys put together a presentation of Claude's career and submitted it to Bakersfield's Bob Elias Hall of Fame. In 1983, Claude was inducted into the Bob Elias Hall of Fame. His contribution to the sport of boxing, his outstanding career as a professional boxer, and his title as featherweight champion of the world were placed in the annals of Bakersfield's outstanding and honored athletes. The Varner family is proud and honored by Claude's achievements and his place in the Hall of Fame. For me, the most important and meaningful Hall of Fame where Uncle Dudley is honored is right here in my heart, and the treasured memories of being bounced on a knee with the words in my mind saying, "How's my pumpkin head?"
Down came a jump up to drink at the Billabong. Up jumped the swagman and grabbed him with glee. And he sang as he shoved that jump up in his tucker bag. "You'll come a waltzing Matilda with me. Waltzing Matilda, waltzing Matilda. You'll come a waltzing Matilda with me." And he sang as he watched and waited till his billy boiled. "You'll come a waltzing Matilda with me." Up rode the squatter, mounted on his thoroughbred. Down came the troopers, 1, 2, and 3. "Who's the jolly jump buck you've got in your tucker bag? You'll come a waltzing Matilda with me. Waltzing Matilda, waltzing Matilda. You'll come a waltzing Matilda with me."
That was Pat Smith reading Uncle Dudley by James Varner, an informative biography of his uncle Claude Varner, whom everyone called Uncle Dudley. Born in 1908, he came from a rugged family where not only he, but several of his brothers became very involved with boxing. He more or less started his professional boxing career in what they used to call the Tin Barn, which at the time had been turned into a boxing arena. It was located just west of what used to be Highway 99, which at the time ran right down the middle of Bakersfield. As we heard, for quite a number of years, Uncle Dudley had quite a career as a boxer. It all culminated in his winning the featherweight championship of the world over in Australia. Tragically, in 1963, he lost his life in an accident between a truck he was driving and a train. At the time, he was survived by his wife Marge and 4 children, as well as his 7 brothers. In 1983, Claude Varner was inducted into Bakersfield's Bob Elias Hall of Fame. We want to thank Claude's nephew, James Varner, for writing such a fine tribute to his uncle, who, as we heard, turned out to be one of our Valley's great boxing champions.
Friends, our author tonight, James Varner, lives in Bakersfield. He attended schools there. After graduating from Bakersfield College, he attended and received a BA in sociology from San Jose State and another BA in architectural science from Cal Poly. From 1964 to 1966, he served in the Peace Corps in North Africa. He's currently engaged in the practice of architecture and also working on more stories about the Varner family. It goes without saying that we hope to see some of these stories in years to come. And so we come to the end of another edition of Valley Writers Read. Thank you for listening. If you'd like to listen to tonight's or any other Valley Writers Read stories again, just go online to kvpr.org and link up with Archived Audio. Next week, our writer-reader will be Hope Knisley. In the meantime, this is your host, Franz Weinschenk, wishing you and yours a great life story until we meet again. Good night.
Valley Writers Read is a production of Valley Public Radio produced by Don Weaver and Franz Weinschenk. Please join us again next Wednesday at 7 p.m. for another edition of Valley Writers Read.